From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! 54 years ago today, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki. Today, in a special live broadcast from the home of the bomb in New Mexico, we'll bring you a look from Native America at the making of that bomb. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Residents of Nagasaki joined in a prayer for peace today, the 54th anniversary of the second atomic bomb attack on Japan in the closing days of World War II. The Nagasaki mayor said in a commemorative ceremony marking the bombing, which killed more than 60,000 people, "Our city of Nagasaki was instantly transformed into charred ruins." He said, "From this hellish experience, we have gained the conviction that the existence of nuclear weapons cannot be tolerated." The attack on the southwestern Japanese city on August 9, 1945, came 3 days after the United States carried out the world's first atomic bombing on nearby Hiroshima in an effort to force the Japanese into surrender. The Hiroshima blast killed 140,000 people. Japan surrendered unconditionally on August 15th. At 11:02, the exact moment of the bombing, people with hands clasped in prayer observed a moment of silence in Nagasaki. Bells at churches and Buddhist temples echoed through the city, 610 miles southwest of Tokyo. The wail of sirens at city fire departments went off at the same time as white doves flapped into the sky. Japan gave official status today to the rising sun flag and an ode to the emperor, ending years of debate over whether symbols linked to Japan's wartime aggression should be recognized under law. The upper house of parliament approved the bill in a 166-71 vote. The law goes into effect on Friday. The flag, a red disc on a white field, and the Kimigayo anthem have long been de facto national symbols. Both are widely used at sporting events, school ceremonies, and on other official occasions. But many in Japan contend that their reminders of a dark period in the country's history, the years early in the century when Japan's war machine sought to build an empire in Asia. A Chinese dissident who was due to be released from a detention center will instead be transferred to a labor camp to serve a longer sentence, this according to a human rights group today. Kai Guiha, a member of the banned China Democracy Party, was detained in Shanghai on October 30th, ordered held without trial for 9 months. More than a week after he was due to be released, the police told his family his sentence had been extended. The police did not say for how much longer he would be imprisoned. Israeli and Palestinian officials continue to voice disagreements about the Y peace accord. A top Palestinian negotiator insisted today that Israel resume a West Bank troop withdrawal in September, but Israeli officials say it won't begin until October. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak has asked Secretary of State Madeleine Albright not to visit the region until the dispute is settled. This news from Darwin, Australia. A court battle begins in Australia tomorrow, pitting two Aborigines against the federal government. The claimants want compensation and punitive damages from the government for taking them from their homes when they were 8 years old. One was removed in 1945, the other in 1956. The court battle should prove an important test case for some 30,000 members of the so-called stolen generation who were taken from their families on the basis of race and placed in institutions. The former state and federal policies were enforced for decades until the late 60s. This news from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Survivors of what could be the worst race riot in the nation's history will get to tell their stories today to a state commission in Oklahoma. The Tulsa Race Riot Commission will hear for the first time from witnesses and survivors of 2 days of violence in the spring of 1921. The panel has been investigating the riot for 2 years and will decide if reparations should be made for white mobs that torched Tulsa's black business district. 62 living black survivors have been located.
Thousands of immigrants jailed by U.S. immigration authorities reportedly may have a chance at freedom. The Washington Post reports the Immigration and Naturalization Service is reviewing cases of immigrants with criminal records who are scheduled for deportation. Immigrants who officials decide are not a threat or who are not likely to flee future court hearings will be released from jail. The review follows a series of court rulings across the country against the INS for detaining all immigrants who had criminal histories. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting live from Albuquerque, New Mexico, from the studios of KUNM at the University of New Mexico. I've been here since last Friday, which was the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima 54 years ago. Today, August 9th, 1945. Is the anniversary of the dropping of the bomb on Nagasaki. And as you heard at the top of the show, today in Nagasaki, residents gathered in prayer for peace today. And the mayor of Nagasaki, Mayor Icho Ito, said in a commemorative ceremony, "Our city of Nagasaki was instantly transformed into charred ruins." In the next two segments of the show, we will be looking at the home of the bomb, where Fat Man, the name of the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki, was created. But right now, we're joined by a survivor of that bombing of Nagasaki. And we welcome you to Democracy Now! And ask you to tell us your story on that day 54 years ago in Nagasaki when the U.S. dropped the atomic bomb.
本山さん、 原爆が落ちた時の体験についてお話ししていただけますか？ 1945年8月9日。今から54年前のこと。August 9th, 1945. 54 years ago is the saddest day that I can never forget。8月8日、8月6日、B29小数機は 新型爆弾を持って広島市を攻撃し、相当の被害を生じたとの新聞報道がありました。On August 8, 1945, newspapers reported a few B-29 bombers attacked the city of Hiroshima with a new type bomb and caused considerable damage.
新型爆弾というのがどんな爆弾であるか誰も知りません。
No one had the least idea what the new type bomb was.
ましてや第二の爆弾がしかも翌9日に長崎に投下されようとは誰一人予想しなかったことです。
Neither did anyone ever expect the second new type bomb to be dropped on Nagasaki.
11時2分、広島に投下されたウラニウム爆弾より大きくファットマンと呼ばれるプルトニウム爆弾が 上空500メートルで爆発しました。
At 11:02 in the morning, August 9th, a plutonium bomb called Fat Man exploded in the air 500 meters above the ground. Its yield was bigger than that of Hiroshima type bomb.
長崎は 363.3 メートルのこんぴら山を中心に 2-300メートルの山
Nagasaki is surrounded with mountains and hills, including Mount Kompira, 363.3 meters high.
コンピラ山の東側は旧市街、西側は原子爆弾の惨禍を帯びた新市街になっています。
The east side of Mount Kompira is the old town area, and the west side is the new town area, which was exposed to the bombing.
一発の原子爆弾によって新市街の裏上一帯は全滅し、長崎市街の3分の1を失ってしまいました。
Only one atomic bomb destroyed the whole area of the new town called Urakami, which was one-third of the city of Nagasaki.
もちろん原爆の被害は全市に及びましたが、コンピラ山が自然の大きな障害となり、
The bomb damaged the whole city, But Mount Kompira worked as a natural shield against the damage of the bombing. Therefore, some parts of the city barely escaped the destruction.
秒速650メートルと言われる爆風は、柔らかい小枝さえも矢のような凶器と化して、人の肌に突き刺さり、300トンもある浦上天主堂の鐘楼ドームは35メートルも飛ばされていました。
The blast wind with a velocity of 650 meters per second changed even fragile twigs into dangerous weapons like arrow. The bell tower of the Urakami Cathedral, which weighed 300 tons, was blown away by 35 meters.
私が被爆したのは14歳の時で、原爆中心地より2.8 キロメートル離れた自宅でした。
I was exposed to the bombing at my house, 2.5 kilometers away from the hypocenter when I was 14 years old.
学徒動員により工場で毎日を過ごしていた私にとって、その日はゆっくりした静かな日でした。
It was a quiet and easy day for me.While I was mobilized with other students to work at a factory every day.
11時になり、そろそろ昼食の準備をと思ったとき、突然ピカッと光が走りました。
A little before 11 o'clock in the morning, I was about to prepare for lunch when a bright flash pierced my eyes.
強烈な閃光に異様を感じ、とっさに押し入れに飛び込みました。
I sensed the danger and dashed into a closet before noticing it.
その後は全く記憶がありません。
What happened after that, I have no idea.
よほど強いショックを受け、気を失ってしまったのでしょう。
Probably I was greatly shocked and lost consciousness.
数分、あるいは十数分経っていたのでしょうか。
Several minutes or 10 minutes have passed when I came to myself.
気がついたときは、目、耳を両手でしっかり塞ぎ、床に伏していました。
When I came to myself, I found myself lying face down on the floor, covering the ears and eyes tightly with my hands.
恐る恐る、目を開いてみると、あたりは一変していました。
When I fearfully opened my eyes, everything around me had completely changed.
途端に、驚きと恐怖、粉々になったガラスの破片が部屋中に広がり、壁には鋭く切り立ったガラスの破片がぎっしりと突き刺さっていました。
I was struck with astonishment and terror. Glass fragments of broken windows scattered all around the room, and countless glass shards pierced onto the wall.
さらに驚いたことには、家具が外まで放り出されていました。
More surprisingly, even furniture was blown out of the house.
柔らかい小枝だって鋭い矢に変える強い爆風。この力は想像以上のものです。
This extraordinary blast power is more than you could imagine.
当時の状況を再現してお見せすることはできませんが、言葉でもこの光景を言い表すことはとてもとてもできるものではありません。
I cannot show you the terrifying scene on the day, neither can I express it with any words.
私は押し入れの奥にいたため、無傷で済みましたが、私をかばって入り口の方にいた姉は、着衣が少しではありますが、焼け、皮膚も火傷していました。
Although I was in the inside of the closet,Thus not hurt, my elder sister got slightly burnt since she was just behind the closet door protecting me.
強い熱線は部屋の中までやってきたのです。
The strong heat rays had even pierced into the house.
中心地より離れ、コンピラさんの裏側の旧市街であったにもかかわらず、しかも室内にいて被害を受けるのですから、屋外にいた人、爆心直下の人たちは、あっという間もなかったことでしょう。
Since she was burnt even inside the house, located in the old town, shielded by Mount Kompira, far away from the ground zero, those who were outside or near the hypocenter must have died in no time.
ふと母の姿が見えないことに気づきました。
I suddenly noticed that my mother was missing.
ガラスの破片がいっぱいの室内、歩き回ることができませんので、姉と二人で、お母さん、お母さんと呼び続けました。
We were not able to walk on the floor covered with broken glasses, so we called out, Mother, Mother, where are you?
一向に返事がありません。
But there was no answer.
さらに呼び続けていると、しばらくして、やられたと言いつつ、手で首を押さえながら姿を見せました。
We kept calling her name, and finally she appeared, covering the neck with her hand, saying, I got hurt.
用があって、別室に行ったちょうどその時、爆風と熱線に遭い、飛んできたガラスが当たったのでしょう。
When she had gone to another room to take something, she must have been hit by the blast and heat rays. A piece of broken glass hit her on the neck.
血だらけで、耳の後ろから首にかけて傷口がぽっかりと開いていました。
She had a big open wound behind the ear and was bleeding badly.
取り急ぎ消毒液を流し込み、布で押さえ、ぐるぐると巻いてあげました。
We hurried to sterilize the wound and put a bandage around the neck.
ガラスの破片の中をどのように歩いて靴を履いたのか、意識はありませんが、考える余裕もなく、無意識に体が動いていたようです。
I don't remember how we walked on the scattered glass pieces and put on shoes, but we seemed to have moved our body without thinking.
母の応急手当が終わると、姉は母を連れて病院へ、私は一人、近くの山へ向かって必死に逃げました。
After we gave first aid to our mother, my sister took her to hospital while I escaped to a nearby mountain.
山から浦上方面を見ますと、薄暗い田舎に黄色の太陽が目につき、もう夕方かと思われました。
When I saw the area of Uragami from the mountain, I noticed a yellow sun in the dusk and thought it was already in the evening.
雲なのか煙なのか、薄らいだ後には真っ赤なしかも全く光のない太陽がポツンと見えました。
After clouds of smoke were clear, there was a bright red sun and yet with no sunlight.
肉眼で太陽を見ているのが不思議でした。
I felt strange to look at the sun with the naked eyes.
その時までは長崎市に何が起こっているのか知る由もなく、しかも浦上一帯が焼け野原になっているなんて信じられないことでした。
At that point, I had no idea what happened to the city of Nagasaki. Neither did I know the Urakami area was turned into burned-out ruins.
時間が経つにつれて、だんだん心細くなってきました。
As time passed, I gradually became uneasy and totally left alone.
山にいると本当に一人ぼっちになりそうな気がしてきましたので、山を降り家へ帰ることにしました。
So I decided to go home.
一方、母を連れた姉の話によると、救護所に行きましたが、傷が大きくて処置できないと拒否され、転々としているうちに、熱線による自然発火で、街路樹、建物が燃え出した第二次火災に出会ってしまいました。
What happened to my mother? My sister had took her to a first aid station, but they were rejected because she was too seriously wounded to be treated. While they were searching for a hospital,They were caught in a secondary fire ignited by the heat rays.
やっとの思いで病院にたどり着き、ろうそくの光で母の傷口は縫合してもらうことができました。
They finally managed to find a hospital where she had the wound stitched up under the candlelight.
病院の庭には次々と怪我人が運ばれ、皮膚が膨れ上がった人、破れた人、泣き叫ぶ人たちでたちまちいっぱいになったとのことでした。
The yard of the hospital was overcrowded with injured victims, with the skin swollen, tattered, and crying in agony. ありがとうございます。
Well, I want to thank you very much for recounting that day as real, clearly for you and should be for everyone in the world today, 54 years later. We've been listening to Sueko Motoyama, who is a Hibakusha from Nagasaki. Hibakusha means a survivor of the atomic bomb, and she has been translated by Sueko. She has been translated by Ria Nakamura, who is a second-generation Hiroshima resident. And I thank you very much for remembering for us as well today. And I should let our listeners know that Sueko Motoyama, the Hibakusha from Nagasaki, Ria Nakamura, the translator, as well as Seiko Ikeda, the Hibakusha from Hiroshima, who we heard from last Friday, will be at a large rally today at Los Alamos National Laboratories, where the bombs were made that were dropped both on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting live from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Today on August 9th, 1999, 54 years after the dropping of the bomb on Nagasaki, is expected to be the largest rally ever at Los Alamos National Laboratories. There will be hundreds of people there, and many of those people may well get arrested as they protest the continued manufacturing of and creation of nuclear weapons. For the rest of the show today, we're going to take a look at New Mexico, one of the poorest countries, one of the poorest states in this country, but look specifically at Native Americans and their interwoven history with the atomic bomb. We're joined right now by Lila Bird, who is staff attorney with New Mexico Environmental Law Center, who was one of the people who presented at a major conference this weekend in Albuquerque called Beyond the Bomb, which was sponsored by Peace Action. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lila.
Thank you. As a staff attorney and an Equal Justice Fellow funded by the National Association of Public Interest Law in Washington, I am representing Eastern Navajo Diné Against Uranium Mining, which is a Navajo citizens group who is fighting the licensing of a uranium mining project in their communities. I believe that this is part of an ongoing legacy of Native American lands and people forced to bear the burden of uranium production in the United States.
We're going to talk about that more in a little while. I got a hold of a book this weekend called If You Poison Us, Uranium and Native Americans. And it starts by saying that the supply of uranium that fueled the Cold War came largely from the Four Corners area of the United States. Some of the richest deposits were found on the Navajo Reservation. Between 1950 and 1980, as many as 15,000 people worked in uranium mines. About one quarter of the miners and millers were Native Americans. Responding to an urgent plea to help defend our country and eager to earn miners' wages, poverty-stricken Native Americans labored to feed the atomic mill for nearly three decades in the face of growing evidence that uranium mining was dangerous. State and federal agencies avoided responsibility for warning the miners or imposing safety measures in the mines. And one of the people that spoke this weekend, in addition to Lila Bird, was Carletta Garcia, who is the daughter of Dorothy Purley, who is a well-known Native American uranium miner. Carletta told the story of her family and uranium.
It's hard to feel, but I'll try my best to do my best. My name is Carletta Garcia. I am a Native American from the Pueblo of Laguna. The Pueblo of Laguna is located 62 miles north of Albuquerque. There are seven main villages on the Pueblo. The village where I was born is called Poati. I would like to start by mentioning again that I am the offspring of Dorothy Purley. Dorothy is a well-known and loved environmental activist and cancer survivor. Many of you who know Mom know how concerned about the future of our world she is. Those of you who know Mom know that she's everybody's mom. I'm also mother to two wonderful children named Zachary and Spencer. Zachary is 16 and a junior in high school. Spencer is 8 and in the third grade. I have been married for 18 years now to a wonderful man named Myron. Myron, who has been recently diagnosed with cancer, is now undergoing chemotherapy. He started yesterday. So as you can see, like my mother, I've also become quite concerned with the future. For 7 years now, my beautiful and loving mother has been dealing with cancer. She was diagnosed one early spring morning in January. As I remember, it was just a week before her 53rd birthday. A week prior to that, when she first told me about the lumps in her right breast, I tried to reassure her and myself that it was probably nothing to be alarmed at. But I knew that I was wrong when I saw the sadness in the doctor's eyes as he quietly came into the examination room after the biopsy. He told us that it was lymphoma. I cried until I could cry no more. I still cry. We were then sent down to the UNM Cancer Center, where Mother went through her first round of high-dose chemotherapy. Doctors prescribed dangerous and lethal drugs to kill off the cancer cells. They warned us that it would also kill off the good cells too. Mom's main concern was never about herself. She worried about her children and her grandbabies. At the cancer center, they told us that she would have side effects from using the chemotherapy treatments. One of the side effects would be to lose her hair. The day came when Mom first lost her hair. My family and I planned to spend the weekend in Poati with her. She called me up on the phone that morning to tell me not to be alarmed because she was starting to lose her hair. As we approached her house, I could see her sitting outside on the picnic bench. She had a forced smile upon her face and a red scarf tied around her head. After the children hugged her and went inside, she called me and asked me if I was ready to see her hair. I said I was. When she untied her scarf, large clumps of her hair came off with it. When the breeze blew, strands of hair went flying. She looked like a half-plucked chicken. We both started to cry and fell into each other's arms. Then we began to laugh and laugh, for humor has always been a big part of our family. It is how we get through those rough times. Since then, Mom has been through chemotherapy on 3 different occasions. Even though she's a real fighter, she has become weaker and is more vulnerable to ailments. My mother, Dorothy, has lived almost all her life on the Laguna Reservation. The Laguna Reservation was once host to the world's largest open-pit uranium mine in North America. The mine is approximately 1,000 feet from the village of Poati, her home. It began its operation in about 1935 and was an economic boost for the poor people of the area. It was wartime, and the price of uranium had skyrocketed. But the people of Poati never knew that their own war was just beginning. As a child, my mother and I would often sit by the cliff, and she would tell me about how beautiful the valley of Poati was before the mining had began its operation. She told me of the orchards that once held peaches, pears, and apples. The gardens below our homes were green with corn, chili, and watermelon. She and her sisters would plant different types of flowers. The women of the village would then dry their fruits and vegetables in the sunshine. The people of the village would have plenty to eat during the cold season. I would sit at the edge of the cliff above the mine, close my eyes, and visualize how it used to look. But when I would open my eyes, all I could see was ugly, gray, and barren, the land before me. In the summer afternoons, my cousins and I would listen for the siren that announced the explosions that happened every day at noon and at 4:30. We'd sit and watch the blast of dynamite loosen the uranium from the earth. A big puff of dust, rock, and soil would billow up into the sky. We could hear the rocks fall back down to the earth. The blast was so intense that it would sometimes shake glasses off the cabinets in the kitchen. If the wind was just right, it would push the foul-smelling dust toward the village. We would pretend that it was a big monster trying to get us and race back into the house to eat our lunch. Little did we know that it was really a monster, one that would chase us for the rest of our lives. As years went by, my mother and other females were introduced into the workforce at the mines. Dorothy worked as a truck driver and hauled high-grade uranium ore to the crusher to be milled and taken back to the Grant site, mill site near Grant's. It was carried by train cars through other nearby villages, including Acoma, where my husband's family lived, into the town of Grants. She also directed the large trucks to dump their loads of uranium ore onto stockpiles for later shipment. Yes, life was good economically in those days. The Pueblo of Laguna was considered to be among the wealthiest tribes and was given honors for being self-supportive. The high school students would plan to work at the mine immediately upon completion of high school. In those days, working at the mine would give you a high-paying job without a degree. Unfortunately for the Lagunas, or should I say fortunately, around the early 1980s, the price of uranium plummeted. We were in peacetime by then, and the people who were employed by the uranium mine were terminated. Around that time, I was also employed at the mine and worked at the repair shop. I serviced trucks that were contaminated with radiation dust particles. The other employees and I ate lunch while sitting alongside the stockpiles of uranium. We were never told about the hazards of radiation. I do not ever recall ever hearing about radiation at all. When the mining operation shut down, things were quite a disaster. People were filing for bankruptcy. Automobiles and mobile homes were repossessed. Everyone was looking for a job, and the graduates did not plan for the future were in a bind. Worst of all was the land. It was mutilated and left like an open sore to fester. The winds blew the contaminated stockpiles for miles, and the rains washed the radiation into runoffs and nearby streams. Our homes were also damaged by the years of dynamite blasting and were in disrepair. Then the people began to become ill. For years now, cancer seems to be a growing epidemic among our people. It seems that every death in our area is related to cancer. People that Mother and I worked with are dying left and right. The tribal government of the Pueblo of Laguna still denies that we have a problem in our hands. My mother and a few of her close friends have formed an organization called the Laguna Acoma Coalition for a Better Environment. This little group is determined to help other tribes and people understand the importance of becoming aware of the dangers of radiation contamination. They have taken surveys in the Puati area and have helped to identify the problems of health, which seem to be specifically related to radiation from the mine. There are many other problems that plague the people of Puati. There is a high rate of miscarriages and stillbirths, mental retardation and physical abnormalities. My mother always tells me that she will fight as long as she is able. On days that she becomes tired, I remind her that she is still needed badly by others. She is needed to educate others by example. I do not know how much longer that I will get to be with her. I hope it is a long, long time. Mother sends her love in regards to everyone. She is in New England as we speak, attending another convention along with other nuclear survivors. In closing, I want to say, let us listen and learn by Mother and others like her. Our elders are so wise and wonderful. We also have future generations to worry about. Always remember our Mother Earth. If we destroy her, we destroy ourselves. If we destroy her, we destroy ourselves. May the Great Spirit bless you and your loved ones. Thank you.
And that was Carletta Garcia from the Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico speaking this weekend at a conference sponsored by Peace Action here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called Beyond the Bomb. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we talk about the history of Native America and the Cold War, our guests are Lila Bird, who is a staff attorney here in Albuquerque with the New Mexico Environmental...
That's New Mexico Environmental Law Center of Santa Fe, New Mexico.
You were telling us, Lila, just before we went to this extremely moving story of Carletta about the fact that uranium mines continue today. In fact, the Navajo are battling the opening, possibly, of another one.
That's right. Hydro Resources Incorporated, a subsidiary of Uranium Resources Incorporated of Dallas, Texas, plans a series of in-situ leached uranium mines and a processing plant in and around the Navajo communities of Church Rock and Crown Point. The Crown Point Uranium Project, as it's called, threatens the only source of drinking water for over 15,000 Navajo people in Crown Point and Church Rock. This new method of uranium mining, which is called in-situ leach mining, would mine uranium directly from the groundwater.
And what are the Navajo doing to prevent this from happening?
Well, naturally, many of the Navajo citizens in that area are fighting to protect their groundwater from this proposed project. The project was licensed in 1998 by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Since then, Eastern Navajo Dene Against Uranium Mining and Southwest Research and Information Center of Albuquerque have been challenging the licensing of that plant. They've submitted brief after brief of expert testimony regarding serious problems with the project regarding liquid waste disposal, cultural resources protection, radioactive air emissions, financial and technical qualifications, problems with financial assurance for decommissioning, numerous environmental justice issues, and numerous NEPA issues.
And NEPA is?
That's the National Environmental Policy Act.
And I know you're getting attention from Washington in your battle against uranium with your meeting this weekend with Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney, who came out to Albuquerque and did meet with the Navajo fighting this uranium mine.
That's right. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney is absolutely alarmed that in 1999 a new uranium mining project would be proposed for Navajo lands. Native American people have suffered over the years at the hands of the uranium mining industry. And it's just incredible to her that even though these communities of Church Rock and Crown Point still to this day have numerous abandoned uranium mines in their area and were the victims of the largest uranium tailing spill back in 1979, that today another company would be proposing such a mine, and that the United States federal agency, which is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, would actually license this mine to operate in these communities. She has extended her total effort and her support to Eastern Navajo Dene Against Uranium Mining.
Well, I want to thank you for bringing us up to date on not a story of 10 or 20 years ago, but remarkably enough, a story of today. The supply of uranium, though, that has fueled the Cold War, the story goes back many decades. And we come back from our break, we'll also be joined by two leaders in the battle for environmental justice and against environmental racism, and also a discussion of Los Alamos National Labs and how they fit into Native American history here in New Mexico. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we broadcast live from Albuquerque, New Mexico, on this 54th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Nagasaki. Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the total fatalities, it's estimated, that occurred 54 years ago and that continue through to today are more than 200,000 people dead. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now. I am Amy Goodman. In addition to Lila Bird of the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, who is here with us as she works with Navajo, who are fighting a new uranium mine here in the Southwest, we're joined by J. Gilbert Sanchez, who is the former governor of the Pueblo of San Ildefonso, which is where the Los Alamos labs are built. He's also executive director of TEWA, Tribal Environmental Watch Alliance, and chair of People of Color Disenfranchised Communities National Environmental Health Network. Also with us is Corbin Harney. He joins us actually from Nevada, came down for the conference this weekend, Beyond the Bomb, which took place in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Corbin Harney is a leader of the Shoshone and with the Shundahai Network, which is based in Las Vegas, Nevada, because Nevada and New Mexico continue to deal with the legacy of the bomb as nuclear tests continue at the Nevada test site. Corbin Harney, let's go to you first. If you could tell us what actually is happening in Nevada right now around the testing of nuclear weapons.
Well, as a Shoshone in Nevada, we're concerned about the life on this planet of ours. We always did try to protest the testing at the Nevada test site. We have been exploding bomb there. More bombs been exploded there at the Nevada test site, a little over 1,066 tests that they have done. We really don't appreciate what the Nuclear Energy Department's been doing. In our part of the country, it took many lives and it continue to take life. What it done to Hiroshima, when we dropped that bomb there, we took many lives for no reason at all. This is something that we should think about as a people around the world. We have took their life, and what did we gain from it? And today, they're still suffering, they're still there, and they're doing their best to keep their home country alive. And today, we, the people out here, should think about those things, what we have done to them. We should never be taking each other's life. We should never be developing bombs on each other around the world. And those are the reasons why the Shoshone people in my part of the country is saying no. Let's unite ourselves together as one people, and then we can put a stop to this nuclear power we talk about. The nuclear power continuously taking the life of all the living things. It's going to continue because we already began to see our waters not usable around the world. Let's think about it. Let's think about it and do something about it. The younger generation needs our support today. They need our help. They had to be educated today what our Nuclear Energy Department has been doing. Now it's getting so bad that we are going to be shipping the nuclear waste from around the world through the country, and someday we are going to suffer from it. I don't know why the Nuclear Energy Department is not concerned about life at all. Life is what we're here for, to protect each other, protect the life of the Mother Earth, the water, the air, and so forth.
Corbin Harney, you're talking about radioactive waste in addition to the actual tests, and you're dealing with everything at the Nevada test site because you've not only got the subcritical tests that are being conducted there, but Yucca Mountain, which is the place where the government has proposed, the U.S. government has proposed to put nuclear waste. Can you describe Yucca Mountain at the edge of the nuclear test site in Nevada?
Yucca Mountain is something that we, the Native people, so that part of the country, we know that the life hills, it's not a mountain like they're claiming to be. All it is just a rolling hills because it's got a cleach running between the top of this mountain and the bottom of this. They're going to put it right next to the water table where they're going to put this nuclear waste. And taking it over there is our concern as a people around the world. Why are we taking it to an Indian country again here? We've been used as a Native people throughout the world. Today, any time when there is a land held by the Indian people, given to them by the federal government, as they made treaties and so forth. They're not even concerned that at all. And today we're asking the people around the world, let's look at the thing that we have done, and let's look at this Yucca Mountain for one. Yucca Mountain is not a safe place. It never will be, because we got so many earthquakes there today. There's already got 33 fault lines in it.
The proposal is to put the radioactive waste inside the mountain.
Inside the mountain. There's a 7-mile tunnel. It's a huge tunnel in this mountain, they call it. But we, the people, know it's not a mountain. All it is, just a rolling hills. And this is the reason why they're putting it there, because we own the land under the Treaty of the Western Shoshones.
Corbin Harney is a Shoshone who has been leading the fight against the establishment of Yucca Mountain as a radioactive waste dump site. And one of the things that was said throughout the weekend at the Beyond the Bomb conference is that if there is no place to put the nuclear waste, it's going to stop the nuclear cycle. That if you can't put the waste somewhere, then it will be incumbent on the Department of Energy and the government to stop producing that waste. J. Gilbert Sanchez, former governor of Pueblo of San Ildefonso in New Mexico, you are the former governor of the area where the Los Alamos labs were built. How were, did they end up being built on your land and the land of your people?
If I may, I would like to start in my language, as my forefathers have taught me, my ancestors gone before me. In the words of my people, during World War II, many of my brothers, our brothers and sisters, grandparents, uncles were volunteers in our armed services of this country. 1943, when the War Department came to our community and asked our elders if they could use that land with the promise of returning those lands back to us upon the conclusion of World War II, which never has happened, was one of the ways and deceptive ways of our government taking the most legendary and most holy places, most sacred of our lands, to build the weapons of destruction. And it has been ongoing since World War II and throughout the Cold War years. Within Los Alamos National Laboratory, we have a significant number of cultural sites as they're described under NEPA and other federal regulations. Los Alamos National Laboratory is also part of the homelands of the homesteaders that came upon to settle upon the plateaus alongside the indigenous peoples. These are the ancestors of the Spanish conquerors who came into our part of the country. Going back, looking at the legacy of what has happened at Los Alamos National Laboratory, true, it is where the atomic bomb was built. We never realized that the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were going to continue the bombardment from the waste, the legendary waste, and the continuation of the research development there at Los Alamos National Laboratory would be impacting upon us. Not to belittle what has happened with the peoples of Japan, especially Hiroshima and Nagasaki, their dosage was a vast amount of dosage in a very short time period, but here in this country, the continuation of research and development, implementation and testing on our people, on indigenous America, all the way from Alaska through the Western Hemisphere, is very, very hard for us to handle from the full cycle of what's happened. All the things that have taken place to build this bomb came from indigenous populations' land. Now they're proposing to put all this waste back into indigenous populations' lands because of our economic standings and whatnot, and so forth. In our community, we were told by the Department of Energy and University of California, Llano, that the groundwater which sits about 2,200 feet below Los Alamos National Laboratory, was going to take 1,000 years to penetrate. But today we're finding that we have contaminations, contaminants of radioactivity and chemicals that have been used in the development of the bomb showing up in our groundwater, in our surface water. We're finding plutonium in the Cochiti Lake area, four separate places in the sediment at Cochiti Lake. We're finding that the environmental health impacts from the research and from the legacy waste is now coming forth in many forms in the downstream pueblos, in the upstream airstream, airflow pueblos and whatnot. We're finding things that are happening to our communities, the illnesses that should not be there are coming about. We're finding a lot of impacts, yet our government and their agencies who are supposed to be, who are charged with finding the causes for some of the causations for some of these illnesses, are afraid to point the finger to our government because of the fact of the liability.
I've heard the term used a lot this weekend. New Mexico is a national sacrifice area. But to put the Los Alamos National Laboratory in a national context, it is one of three laboratories run by the University of California, the makers of the nuclear weapons of this country. You have Los Alamos National Laboratory, Lawrence Livermore in California, and the Sandia National Labs also right here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. By the way, there is a strike going on right now of workers at Sandia National Laboratories who are striking over pay, benefits, and job classification. But this issue of the University of California running the national laboratories here. Can you elaborate on that, Gilbert Sanchez?
I certainly can, and I think that the colonization of this country had was supposed to have ended some 200 or at least 200 years ago. But here in this state of New Mexico, we have a colony. We are being colonized by the state of California. The colonization is continuation. And the Department of Energy and the United States government is fostering this colonization as we go on. The University of California is protected in three ways. One is by the laws of New Mexico because they're not as stringent as California. The other is by California laws because California laws can be applied at this colonial sites and that of the United States government as we speak, as we move forward. Because anytime they have a choice. They have a smorgasbord of environmental regulations that they can go to and say, this is what we're working under today, because yesterday we were caught doing this thing. But it is very strenuous. The state of New Mexico could be directly benefiting. Up until about 7 years ago, the state of New Mexico was three points above Alabama and Mississippi in the economic standards of this country. All of a sudden, we fell down to the bottom of the pit. We're now 50th in the economic standings of this country.
The poorest country in
right.
the United States.
Right. We are called a country because the United States, people in this country overlook the fact that we are a state. They always consider us part of Mexico. So I guess that is a correct nomenclature.
Lila Bird, the issue of University of California running things here in New Mexico is one that you've taken on as well.
Well, there is a whole issue of outside colonization of New Mexico, and I think we see that here where mining companies from different parts of the country feel that they can come in and mine uranium directly from someone's groundwater or in their communities. I don't think you would see such a thing being proposed for Dallas, Texas, or for Albuquerque, or for even Santa Fe, New Mexico. But they see a Native American community, and they think that no one will care.
Now, you're having a conference, actually, very soon around the issue of uranium mining.
That's right. I'd like to invite everyone out to Crown Point, New Mexico on August 20th. We expect tribal and federal representatives, as well as church officials and Texas citizens to come discuss this issue of uranium mining in Navajo communities. And if you want more information, please give me a call at the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. My number is 505-989-9022.
One more time.
That's 505-989-9022.
Gilbert Sanchez, you too are involved with a large gathering that is going to be taking place.
Yes, we're going to be having our third annual gathering for Mother Earth and the Nuclear Free Futures Awards on September 25th and 26th at the Pueblo Pewaukee's Ben Verial Powwow Grounds. And we'd like to invite everybody. And if you need more information, you can contact myself or my wife, Kathy Sanchez, who is really the spearhead of this gathering for Mother Earth, Table Women United, at 505-747-7100.
One more time, that phone number.
505-747-7100.
And final words today from Corbin Harney as we wrap up 2 days of programming from Albuquerque, New Mexico, from the cradle of the bomb, the book that I referred to at the beginning of this program, If You Poison Us, Uranium and Native Americans. That line, "If you poison us," comes from Shakespeare, The Merchant of Venice. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die?
We have asked many, many peoples around the country, around the world, to come to Nevada Test Site from October the 7th to the 11th, so that way we can protest and try to shut down the Nevada Test Site through what they have been doing so far. As a Native people of this world, today we are trying to do something and put a stop to this nuclear power we talk about. How cheap it is, but it's taken many lives. And it's going to continue to take life if we don't put a stop to it. You are the people out there. You are the one is going to have to do it. We cannot do it as an Indian people. We're concerned about a lot of things. We see a lot of things, what the government has been done to us for the 500 years.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for joining us today. And a last phone number of the Shundahai Network is 702-647-3095. Corbin Harney of the Shundahai Network, 702-647-3095. You can get all those numbers on our website at www.pacifica.org. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of the program, 1-800-735-0230. Today, Democracy Now! Has been produced by David Love, Maria Carrion, with help from Suzette Ermler, production assistance from the studios of KUNM from Tristan Klum, engineer today Chip Barton, and thank you very much to all those who have helped out, including Juliet Jordan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!